The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
There were some memorable characters in Donald Trump's administration during his presidency, but the most memorable, arguably, was probably Trump's former communications director, Anthony Scaramucci. Now, the Mooch, as he's known, was in the role for 11 days, and if you dare say 10, he'll quickly correct you. And he's got a lot of thoughts about what might happen to America and the world if Trump gets another go in the White House. Now, I saw Anthony at an event at Bloomberg House in Davos, and he was actually in a corner with 15 people laughing around him because he really brings some of these stories alive. He's pretty dramatic. And in Davos, everyone was trying to figure out what a Trump 2.0 in the White House would mean and whether he would get it. So I thought it made sense to get someone who was alongside Trump during the campaign and with him for part of the ride in the White House into our studio here in London. So this week, a conversation with Anthony Scaramucci about whether a Trump presidency would be more right-wing, how dangerous he would be, or how beneficial he would be for financial services, and why he's such a believer in Bitcoin. Welcome to In the City. From Bloomberg's offices in the heart of the Square Mile, this is our weekly podcast about the stories driving the conversations of policymakers, power brokers, and financiers in the power centers the world over. I'm Francine Lacqua.
And I'm David Merritt.
Allegra actually sitting this one out, Dave.
Yes, here in spirit, if not in body.
Always. Now, I'm really excited, Dave, about this week's interview with Anthony Scaramucci, which we actually did with a friend of the show, our opinion columnist, Adrian Woolridge.
Yes, it just feels incredibly timely to speak to somebody with such firsthand knowledge of Trump, how he operates, and who had a ringside seat first time round to think about what might happen if he gets back in the White House. It is, well, you mentioned it was on everyone's mind at Davos, Francine. I mean, I'm going to be back in America next week. It is certainly on everyone's mind there. The election's not till November, but it's going to be upon us before we know it.
Yeah, and Anthony Scaramucci has this unique insight because he was really a Trump lover, right? He backed Trump. He went to work for Trump. And now he's like one of the fiercest critics of Donald Trump.
That is the amazing thing, isn't it? The swing of opinion here from lover to hater. And, you know, we are tracking closely, of course, across America, a public opinion about Donald Trump, who, as we all know, is very divisive. We've got a poll that we're running every month. It's in the seven, what they call the purple states, the swing states. Did you see the one that was out this week, Francine? This was a particularly interesting one because it showed for the first time a bit of a bump for Biden, attributed maybe to some of his perceived success at the State of the Union address, but he is narrowing the gap in those crucial states. Now, are people clutching at straws here to think, is there some hope for Biden, because he's still behind in lots of these places, or is this the start of a new trend?
It's interesting because Anthony Scaramucci doesn't think Trump will get in, although he's much better organized, so he's a better campaigner, he says, and if he does get in the White House, he'll know what to do, so he could be potentially more dangerous for U.S. democracy, Scaramucci says, and for the rest of the world.
You know, but this is one of the things, isn't it, that we all remember, or maybe we've sort of collectively forgotten a bit, back in 2016. No one thought Trump was going to win then. And, you know, sort of here we are again at this point where the media, commentators, even people who were at the ringside seat are saying, no, it's not possible. It's not going to happen. So I'll be visiting the Washington Bureau next week. And I definitely get the sense from everybody there that, you know, November is going to be upon us before we know it. And this is a rematch. It's looking pretty certain between Biden and Trump. So everyone is dusting themselves off for that. And acknowledging, you know, covering Trump administration last time round was exhausting. You never knew what was going to happen when you woke up every day. So everyone is bracing for more of that. But, you know, our coverage out of DC, of course, will be spectacular. We've got our Washington newsletter. We've got a podcast every week. We've got our daily news show. So check it all out on Bloomberg.com. Good plug.
Nice, shameless plug, Dave. But we do We're pretty on top of it. Here's our conversation with the former White House Communications Director, Anthony Scaramucci. Adrian, how excited are you by having Anthony Scaramucci? I'm excited.
I'm okay. Exceptionally excited.
Because for the next hour...
Flattery will get you everywhere with me.
Because for the next hour, we'll listen to stories of what it was like working for 11 days with Donald Trump, his prediction on the U.S. economy, and we'll talk a little bit about the markets too. Thank you for joining us.
It's awesome to be here.
Do you ever get tired of talking about your time in the White House?
You know, I mean, if I'm asked about it, I'll talk about it. You know, I like talking about it with kids because it was such an epic fail. And getting fired like that was it was the appearance of a catastrophe. And I think it's a good thing to talk to kids about where you can have missteps in your life or you can step on a landmine, but you can survive it and what you need to do to pull yourself back together. So I don't really mind talking about it. I think the issue for me, which I don't like because it's a really poor reflection on me, is why did I actually go work for Trump in the first place? I think that is a poor reflection on me, and it speaks to perhaps a weakness in character. It speaks to ego, and it speaks to pride, because ultimately, that was a prideful decision. It's a cautionary tale about putting your ego and your pride into your decision-making.
So you didn't do it to serve the country? You wanted to be in the White House?
No, I certainly did it to serve the country, but you have to understand, you have a round peg in a square hole. Okay, I worked as a Wall Streeter for 30 years. I went to a couple of good schools. I grew up in a blue-collar neighborhood. Now I can serve the American president. But the American president's crazy. And so people that had their pride out of the equation, like my very good friend Vinnie Viola. I don't know if you would recognize that name, but he ran Virtu, is the president of the Merck. He was named by Donald Trump to be the Secretary of the Army. For 2-hour meetings with Trump, he withdrew himself from the position. And when I asked him why he did it, he said, you know, after spending more time with Mr. Trump, I realized I really couldn't work for him. He didn't have the right executive management skills, highly insecure person. He's not able to share credit. A result of which I'm withdrawing myself from the position. And he too was an Army veteran, went to, you know, West Point, served the country, wanted to be the Secretary of the Army, but he felt it was incongruous with Trump's personality. I wasn't brave enough to make that statement. I was smart enough, but my ego was in the way.
Do you think Trump has deteriorated over the years? Do you think he'll be worse next time around than he was last time?
Well, he'll be significantly worse, but not because he's deteriorated. I think everybody deteriorates over time. He's going to be 78 years old, so he's a little slower. But that's not the issue for Trump. The issue for Trump is that he's now experienced. He's now been in the White House. He's lost the White House. If he gets the job again, he'll be very, very dangerous in that job. And he's also got some very experienced campaign people with him now that believe in the expansion of unitary executive power. And this is very, very dangerous for the society.
Can you say a little bit more about the sort of people he's got around him? Because it seems to me that they're different from last time. Last time had a lot of Republican establishment, a lot of moderates, a lot of people who didn't quite know what they were getting themselves in for. This time it seems to be true believers. Is that right?
I would say that that's right. I'm a little bit of a contrarian on this because I really know the beast of Donald Trump. He's such a name dropper. Adrian is such a status seeker that those people won't rise in the cabinet. He's got them in the campaign now. They're very disciplined. He'll probably try to bring Manafort back because Manafort has back channels into foreign money. So those people are loyalists to Trump, but also the idea of massive expansion of executive power. And this is actually a Dick Cheney concept. So this is like a Frankenstein monster that was unleashed by Cheney in the early part of the 2000s, perpetrated by him and George W. Bush. And now it's become this Frankenstein golem of Donald Trump. And so this is something that we have to stop immediately. And then you have to ask yourself, once Trump is stopped, which I predict he will be stopped, what comes after Donald Trump? Is there a worse monster coming, or can we renew the American experiment? Can we renew the American democracy?
What do you mean he'll be stopped? So you don't think, first of all, how did he get the Republican nomination? And you don't think he becomes president?
Well, he definitely doesn't become president. No, you have to look at the data very carefully. And you have to remember in the United States, you have something called the Bradley effect, And so Mayor Tom Bradley, first African-American mayor in our history, when he was running for re-election, when the pollsters called, they said, are you voting for Mayor Bradley? People said, yes. There was a 9-point spread between the poll and the actual election. Bradley lost the election. And the people said they didn't want to appear racist to the person on the phone. They didn't want to vote for Bradley because they didn't think he was competent at his job. It had nothing to do with his skin color. And so what's happening right now with Trump is that there's more media exposure for him relative to Biden. And there's people that actually like what's going on at the border. They're going to vote for Joe Biden, but they're telling people that they don't like what's going on at the border. And the other big issue for Donald Trump is that they're going to run the replay film of his full-on insanity, the craziness of the insurrection, the insanity around the COVID-19 situation.
But how did
you see
he
what
get,
I'm saying?
Did he get the nomination?
He got the nomination because he's got an ardent support base of 20% of the American population that feel left out. And this is another problem with the United States. It's another problem with the UK. Our political establishment, primarily baby boomers, have failed these countries, okay? Specifically talking about the United States, the baby boomers are indulgent, they're selfish, they got passed the baton from the greatest generation of a vanquished fascism in Europe and architecture that rebuilt the world for peace and prosperity, led by the UK, the United States, and the family of liberal Western democracies. And so we've grown tired of it. That happens in history. If you study Barbara Tuchman's books, The Guns of August, as an example, when we lose our wartime memory, we're 80 years out from the D-Day invasion now. And when we lose our wartime memory, our living memory, we have a tendency to glorify war and we increase our propensity towards nationalism. And so that's happening right now. And rather than going back to the principles that got us to where we are, our politicians become more tribal, they become more insular. It's also being helped by the former Soviet Union through their server farms. They're pushing a lot of this narrative into the internet. It's a lot of garbage that's showing up on social media that references all of this. And Trump plays right into that.
Can I push you a bit on the Bradley effect? Because surely you could get the opposite conclusion from the Bradley effect. We have people in this country called shy conservatives. The number of people who actually vote conservative is generally bigger than the number of people who say they will be, because people don't want to be associated with this, you know, this slightly disreputable party in their mind. Isn't the same thing true of Trump? A lot of people will say they're not going to vote for Trump, who actually, when they go into the ballot box, they unleash their inner Trump.
I would say that was true in 2016. It was not true in 2020. I don't believe it's the case in 2024. And so what you're saying was a 2016 phenomenon. But in 2024, he's a known entity. He has very high negatives. Nobody's won the presidency with this high of a negative. He has not won a plurality of Americans. He's never had a higher approval rating above 50% at any time that he was in the presidency. But I'm telling you, the American people are going to choose older and mildly forgetful to full-on insanity.
But surely a lot depends on whether Biden makes mistakes.
Yeah, and people go and vote, actually.
Is if Biden makes a few crucial mistakes.
You know what I love about you guys? I mean, I'm going to push.
That's bad.
Can I push back on you too? Because I love you guys, okay? Because you know, this is like the Davos set. We were in Davos together, right? And so I've been going to Davos for 17 years. Davos is always wrong. In 2007, they told us that the trees were going to grow to the sky and we had solved all of our monetary policy problems. In 2009, in January, they said that the world was going to open and we were all falling into the earth. We're going to go to the worst depression since the 1920s. We had the greatest bull market run in history. 2016, Davos said, Hillary Clinton's going to be president. There's no reason to have the election. 2020, with absolute certainty, Trump was going to win the election. Now in 2024, Trump is going to win the election.
I'm not saying that. He's just not going to win the election. But I do think there's a big chance.
I'm sorry?
Especially on the economy.
Never underestimate your enemy.
In Davos, Jamie Dimon, okay, JP Morgan,
yeah,
went on a rival channel and he said, let's just take a step back.
He's kind of right about NATO. He's kind of right about immigration. He grew the economy quite well. Is this economy going to let Joe Biden down?
So with all respect to Jamie, because I think he's one of the smartest people that I've ever met. He's certainly one of the smartest people in the financial services. I have an intellectual disagreement with him on the cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin, but he's a lot smarter than me. So I'll cede economic points to him. But Trump lost 21 million jobs on his watch. Look, he totally and completely mishandled the COVID-19 situation. He has no executive management skills, and he disorganized the executive branch of the United States, which includes 19 cabinet and sub-cabinet level agencies and departments that were paralyzed by Donald Trump and his Twitter account. And so he is the wrong guy for that job. Now, if you want to say, because let's be objective on your podcast, that he has points to be made on deregulation, he has points to be made on economic growth, he does have those points. He blew the tax reform. He did nothing to help the 20% of the people that put him back in the nomination, his ardent supporters, he has done nothing for. He's an avatar for their anger. He represents an orange wrecking ball into the establishment to smash the establishment.
Do they see that? Because if you think, even if he's done nothing for you, if you think that there's one person that fights for you, you're going to get him reelected.
He's not fighting for them as much as he's striking a match to the establishment. So he's done nothing for them. Joe Biden, through his legislative accomplishments in the last 3 years, has done way more for those people, but he's a very poor messenger,
right?
Because
so
he's
don't
frail.
See it.
The people that voted for Lyndon Johnson or Jack Kennedy, you know, their grandparents or their great grandparents that voted for Franklin Roosevelt, many of those people are aligned with Trump now because the Democrats seeded those people. The establishment Democrats say we're going to focus on transgender bathrooms, pronoun usage, DEI. That's going to be our champion in this generation. The white lower middle class and the working class have been left disenfranchised by both parties. Like or dislike Donald Trump, he saw that. He went into those communities. I went into those communities with him, 71 campaign stops with him on the Trump plane. I saw the blight in those communities. I grew up with those people. And again, this doesn't reflect well on me, but this is my cognitive bias because I've hung out in the salons of the wealthy, and I hung out in Davos, and I went to work at Goldman, and I went to Harvard Law School. These people don't think like the blue-collar people I grew up with. And so when I arrived on the Trump campaign in 2016, and I was in New Mexico, and somebody, a blue-collar worker, looked at me and said, oh, you think you're in New Mexico? New Mexico, that would be Mexico, because that's where the factory that I was working in and my dad was working in moved to. So this is no longer New Mexico. And those people who Trump has done nothing for, they'll vote for him anyway because he wants to wreck the establishment. He wants to destroy the system, and they don't like the system because the system hasn't worked for them.
How did the liberal establishment get things so wrong? How did it create so much, I think, just some often justified animosity against itself?
Complacency. They got very complacent. They took for granted the votes. Hillary Clinton looked at Wisconsin and said those are primarily union workers and blue-collar people. She did not show up in Wisconsin. Trump went 7 times to Wisconsin after the Republican convention. So his messaging, he sucked as president, let's just be honest. And he sucks for the world order, and he sucks for peace and global prosperity. But he's a wonderful communicator, and he's got tireless energy, and he resonates with a very large group of people that feel left out of the system.
Do you think the liberal establishment has learned anything from what happened in 2016?
Joe Biden has. Joe Biden put legislation in place for reshoring. He put the CHIPS Act in place. He passed an infrastructure bill.
I want to talk a bit about the UK, but if Donald Trump goes bankrupt, does that make a difference to the American psyche in the run-up to the election?
So not to his core base. They'll vote for him no matter what. Bankrupt, in jail. He could be campaigning with an orange suit on a Zoom call from a jail cell. They're still going to vote for him. Okay, they've decided they're in that cult. They've decided he can do absolutely no wrong. But the people that matter are the independents. The suburban women are going to drive this election. And again, you know, if you've got two movies that are playing in the United States in 2024, Weekend at Bernie's and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I'm going with Weekend at Bernie's. I'll take one guy who's got one foot on a banana peel, the other one in the casket, over a guy that needs a lobotomy, that's certifiably crazy, that wants to demolish the post-World War II architecture, wants to destroy the institutions of the American democracy.
You've painted a pretty depressing picture of the choice that America faces in the next election.
I mean, I'm painting an accurate picture.
Well, it's not depressing and contradictory things, but how did you get into this position as a country, as the most important country in the world?
So the answer to that, there's a couple of things that happened. One of them is Citizens United. One of them is Ross Perot. Ross Perot actually caused this. He didn't realize it at the time, but he scared the daylights out of the oligarchic duopoly known as the Demopublicans. Okay, so they had a duopoly going quite strongly. Perot entered the race, got 19.9% of the vote, freaked them out. So they strengthened their duopoly by going into the state and local governments and tightening the restrictions on having a third party enter a race. You know, you've got to get thousands and thousands of petitions. You have to follow this weird labyrinth of laws and procedures to get on the ballot. And they did all of this to strengthen the duopoly. They then ceded to each other's gerrymandering. And so for your UK listeners, that basically means these local governments, the state and local and the governors, can look at the map and they can reconfigure the congressional district. So when I was growing up as a kid, these districts looked like geometric shapes that you could recognize from ninth grade geometry. They now look like jigsaw puzzles pursuant to whose house is where, and they try to carve out their enemies. So the U.S. actually needs a constitutional amendment on that. And so you're asking, so I want to keep going because I want to explain this to the people. You have Citizens United. There was a very famous case in the United States called Plessy versus Ferguson. This case had to do with racial segregation. The court ruled that you could have separate but equal facilities in the United States, and this doomed any potential for the integration of the races in the America. This was an unmitigated disaster for the country. It was reversed by Brown versus the Board of Education. This has been a disaster for the United States. And so Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. What did he say? If you have unlimited amounts of money, it's your First Amendment right to use that money in the political process. You can set up a PAC and you can spend unlimited amounts of money. And they accidentally created a separate but equal democracy. And so now go look at the legislative accomplishments of that Congress, which is primarily a failed system now because they get nothing done. But when they do get something done, it's corporate welfare, it's kleptocracy, it's big pharma, big food, put fertilizer in the Cheerios, no problem. I'm going to get reelected if we do that. And you have this charybdis of nonsense that's taking place inside the United States as a result of all this money flowing into the system. So that court case has to be reversed, or there needs to be a constitutional amendment to make the democracy fairer again, because it's a two-tiered system now. So that's how we got there. 14% approval rating for the Congress, yet a 94% reelection rate for an incumbent. So what other group of people could have a 1 out of 5 consumer rating and not care about it? It's these people because they rig the system and the politicians are picking the voters through gerrymandering as opposed to the voters picking the politician. The United States is being victimized right now by not having the DNA to understand fascism. Everybody here in Europe understands it because they have legacy from their families. The Americans missed it. So we have no memory of fascism, a result of which we glorify, at least a group of us do, people like Donald Trump. Here in Europe, they look at it and say, well, wait a minute, my grandfather died because of this, or my uncle died, and they worry about fascism.
But the right in Europe is gathering strength.
So the right in Europe is gathering strength because the wartime memories, are fading, and a result of which the educational system is not pressing the people hard enough to understand the horror of what that represents. And so we don't have that in the U.S., and so we need that.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bitcoin, you were an early adopter.
I wish that you're very flattering. I wish I was an early adopter. I actually am an early adopter for an old man who grew up in traditional finance. So I was 4 years ahead of BlackRock, but I'm not an early adopter.
You've been defending it for a pretty long time.
I have, yeah. Right? And I took a lot of bullets and was involved in the FTX fiasco, which cost me a lot. But I believe long-term in the technical properties of Bitcoin. And I believe that the network effect of Bitcoin will be incredibly valuable, and Bitcoin will emerge as a digital store of value. And it may not be for my generation, but it'll certainly be for my children that are 30 years younger than me. And, you know, and the good news is people like Larry Fink, who when I first met with him, he hated Bitcoin, but now he's been orange pilled by the Bitcoiners, and he has the largest, most successful ETF in his history, in BlackRock's history, as a result of wading into the pool with us. So you know, Bitcoin is here to stay, and you know, it will trade, in my opinion, to the market capitalization of gold over the next decade.
I was going to ask you about gold because there's something funny in the markets, right? Gold up, Bitcoin up. That's a little bit counterintuitive. Like, what's going on in markets?
I don't think so. I think what's going on in markets is that there's been a massive production and massive proliferation of fiat currency. What's going on in markets is a massive debt-laden society now, and people are trying to figure out, well, is that sustainable? It may be sustainable for the next decade, but is it sustainable for a century? Doesn't seem like it would be, a result of which, where can I put my money where I can store value and I can protect the money? So both of those places, one is 5,000-year-old history of storing value in, and the other one is a newer technology. And so I think that there's a marketplace for both of those things. And so it doesn't not make sense to me, you know, that 3%, 4%, 5% in each of those while we're going through this. But remember, You're operating in the United States now with 6% of the GDP is going to deficit spending. So you have to just think about how remarkable that is. And you have to look at the scale of the percentage of the national debt to the overall GDP of the country. It's now through World War II levels. But right now, we're not fighting World War II. And so you have to ask yourself, what are we doing? What are we doing? We're overpromising and we're under-delivering. And just for all your viewers and listeners, listen up. Deficit spending is unfunded tax liability. Okay, someone's going to pay it. Okay, maybe it won't be you, but it'll be your grandchildren. And how will they pay it? Well, they'll depreciate the fiat currency. They'll monetize the debt. They'll pay back the debt with dollars that are worth less than the ones that they borrowed. And that will crush living standards for the lower and middle class. And these are the people that will show up at a Bernie Sanders rally or a Donald Trump rally because they're upset about it. They don't like the fact that you're stealing their time and energy.
How come this deficit spending is not an issue in the election? It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, it's not an issue because the people that vote are older, and the people that vote that are older, they want those benefits. And Donald Trump's not stupid. Joe Biden, and both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have said, even though it's the absolute wrong thing to do, they're not going to correct the issues related to entitlement obligations in the United States. Older voters like that, they want those benefits, and so therefore it's not an issue. But will it be an issue down the road if there's a fiscal or a debt crisis for the United States? Now, the best thing that the United States has going for it are the other countries. Also, the U.S., because of the predictability of the laws, legal system, the flow of capital, the mantle of financial services leadership, the fact that we have the largest military, and the fact that the most important commodity, oil, is priced in U.S. dollars, makes the dollar the global reserve currency. And so for all of those reasons, you know, the U.S. should be able to maintain its leadership if it gets the right political leaders, gets the right policies. But this generation of leaders has failed the country, and we all know that. And so the question is, what will the next generation, where our children do better than us? And I hope so. Otherwise, there'll be a big crisis.
Can you see a next generation? Can you identify some people who might be the leaders of the future?
No, I can't see it off the top of my head, but I predict that they're going to be better than us. I predict that they'll be more data dependent. They'll be a little bit more technocratic than we were. And I think that they'll tighten the belt where necessary. And by the way, I mean, you talk about depressing. Let's talk about something optimistic. Every one of these problems is fixable. As Jack Kennedy once said, we made the problems. Man, he said man. Could have said man and woman, but it was 1960, so he said man. And he said man can fix the problems. Okay, so maybe men and women can fix the problems, but we can fix the problems. But there's nobody in the West that has a 10 or 15-year plan to fix the problem. You know, you could fix the deficit, no problem. It'd take 25 years to do it. You need a bipartisan commitment. But if you could explain to the American people, look, this is what we need to do. It's not left. It's not right. It's about right or wrong. These are the policies that we need to put in place. If we do this for 25 years, we can bring the deficit down and we can sustain the economic and therefore the national security of our country if we do this. But the current political leadership doesn't want to do it.
But this is a G7 problem. The UK has a similar problem, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking in an American-centric way because I'm an American. But yes, the UK has this problem. The French have this problem. The Germans have the problem. Yeah, this is a problem. This is a cultural problem because politicians need to get reelected to serve themselves more than they want to serve the people that they're supposedly serving, okay? If this was about public service as opposed to personal power, we would never be making the decisions the way we're making them.
Anthony Scaramucci, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, nice to be here. Thank you, guys.
So it was a really fun conversation, and it was a good insight into Donald Trump's psychology as a man who was president. My main takeaway is that Scaramucci does not think he'll be president again because he thinks the polls are off. So he says when pollsters call your house in America, a lot of people say they'll vote for Trump because it sounds patriotic, but actually they'll vote for Biden even if they're a bit ashamed
right,
of it.
So the sort of secret Biden...
Biden lovers.
Lovers, really?
Yeah.
Lurking in the back.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
You know, Brexit, we had like the secret Brexiteers, which is why the polls were off. So it's an interesting dynamic that he thinks it's this way around.
Yeah. Well, a lot more polls for us to chew over the coming months, not least the Bloomberg one that we're running every month. But I think talking of shameless plugs that we had at the beginning, another one coming here because we are going to be starting to make a bonus show that's going to be hitting your feeds every week. And it is to tackle this subject. It's where this is the year of elections all around the world. It's also the year that geopolitics is really crashing into boardrooms as well. And business people are trying to work out how to navigate all of the political turmoil that we're going to see all around this year. So our new podcast is called Votonomics.
Votonomics.
you heard it here first. And listen every week coming soon. And we're going to be tapping into the biggest brains in the newsroom here on geopolitics and economics, including Stephanie Flanders, who runs Bloomberg Economics and government all around the world.
Yeah, Allegra, Adrian Woolridge, and yourself. It'll be fun.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
Thanks for listening to This Week's In the City from Bloomberg. This episode was hosted by me, Francine Lacroix, with David Marriage and featuring opinion columnist Adrian Woolridge. It was produced by Summer Sadi, additional editing by Rishi Bujaykul. Brendan Newman is our executive producer. Sage Bauman is head of podcasts. And special thanks to Anthony Scaramucci. Please subscribe, review, rate wherever you listen to podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.